Hello, and welcome to the New World. Episode 17, Taking Tawantinsuyu. When last we left off, Pizarro and his band of a few hundred conquistadors were just leaving the town of Cajamarca after executing their captive, the Sapa Inca Atahualpa. Atahualpa had thought that the Spanish, who more or less kidnapped him, were going to leave as soon as they collected every last bit of precious metal he had. Once Pizarro gained this money, however, he stayed. Atahualpa realized with great despondency that these were not loot-crazed barbarians, but the first wave of invaders who fancied themselves the start of a new class of landed gentry in Peru. With the execution of the Inca emperor, the future of their prospective client state was in jeopardy, so Pizarro set out to the capital of Cuzco to hopefully seize control of the nation. But getting to Cuzco was easier said than done. If you listened to episode 15, then you would know that the Inca highway system, an extensive and advanced network of paved roads and carved-out pathways, was designed to be traversed as quickly as possible. The only problem, though, was that it was mainly designed to be traversed on foot, or by llama. It was absolutely not designed for the comparatively massive horses that the Spaniards brought. Not only could the roads be too small for them in some cases, but horses are naturally suited for wide open spaces, not the incredibly steep and rocky slopes of the Andes. So unaccustomed were the Spanish to the rocky Inca highways that it was impossible for any conquistador to ride his horse. Instead, they were forced to dismount and carefully lead their animal forward. Remember how I said that the Inca had perfected this system and that a team of runners could move a message nearly 150 miles a day? Well, it took Pizarro and his men about 3 months to travel the 600 miles or so from Cajamarca to Cuzco. Along the way, Pizarro suffered a more significant setback in his quest to maintain control of Tawantinsuyu. He had captured Atahualpa back in Cajamarca, but he also had his son, Tupacualpa. Though Atahualpa had never clearly outlined who would succeed him, Pizarro decided to have Tupac crowned as emperor anyway, and brought him along to Cuzco to actually cement his authority as their puppet. The only problem was, midway along their arduous trip, Tupac got sick and died, meaning Pizarro was now fresh out of Sapa Incas. That is, until a few weeks later. In November 1533, they encountered an 18-year-old man named Manco. Though he looked a little better than a common peasant, Manco revealed that he had been on the run from his brother, the Emperor Atahualpa. He was apparently one of Huayna Capac's younger sons, meaning that he was most definitely a prospective heir to the throne. Pizarro gladly took Manco along, because not only could he have a new puppet emperor, but he could also have Manco help with his main problem, the army of 30,000 men still occupying Cuzco. You see, Pizarro may have dismantled Atahualpa's army at Cajamarca, but there was no reason to disband the other ones that were still across the country. Therefore, the men who had captured Cuzco from Huascar several months ago had no reason to leave the city. The general of this army, a man named Quisquis, was decidedly unfriendly to the Spanish. His men ambushed the conquistadors on their way to Cuzco and succeeded in killing at least five of them before they managed to ride off into the distance. With this small defeat, Pizarro became convinced that rather than try and fight the Spanish, Quisquis would simply burn Cuzco to the ground and prevent Pizarro's puppet Manco from being enthroned. So when, on the outskirts of the city, the Spanish spotted smoke, 40 conquistadors under Hernando de Soto and Juan Pizarro split off to try and stop them. Now, upon a bit of a plateau, they were able to finally mount up and gallop off into the distance and make full use of their horses. Thanks to Kim Macquarie and her book The Last Days of the Incas, we get a good explanation of both the Spanish and the Inca forces on this day. The Spanish conquistadors of Pizarro's army were well outfitted. They carried steel armor, including a steel kettle helmet and a chainmail undershirt. Shields differed between smaller wooden ones for infantry and larger hide ones for cavalry. Horsemen carried either swords or lances, while their horses wore thick cotton padding for protection. Infantry had a multitude of armaments, including swords, spears, crossbows, or the early firearm known as the arquebus. Part of Spanish strategy in general, but especially in the Americas, was to attack, attack, attack. They depended on the shock value of their weaponry and the speed and power of their horses to strike fear into the enemy and deal a massive amount of damage in a short amount of time. McCory makes sure to note that, in this day, the only people who even knew how to properly deal with a charge by mounted European knights were other Europeans, who could try and blunt an attack or stop the knights before they got close by massing groups of pikemen or using their own firearms. The Incas under Quisquis that day in 1533 had neither. What they did have was just about as much variety in weaponry as the Spanish. Soldiers of Tawantinsuyu had copper breastplates along with thick cotton armor capable of stopping the blows of other Andean warriors. Inca infantry, and they were only infantry, used clubs or axes designed to break bones and crush skulls. This might seem a little barbaric to you, but a European mace, a weapon that was still in use by this time, performed the exact same function. They also had bronze spears and javelin throwers like the Aztec atlatl, and auxiliaries from the Amazon rainforest utilized bows and arrows in small amounts. Their most prominent weapon was the sling. An Inca slinger could throw stones quickly and with great accuracy. So accurately, in fact, that McQuarrie says Spanish swords were snapped in half after being hit by a keen-eyed slinger. Despite this, the Incas used no iron weapons, if for no other reason than the fact that iron ore is extremely rare in the Andes. Unfortunately for Quisquis and his men, neither their slings, nor their clubs, nor even their arrows could penetrate the thick steel plates of Spanish armor. But they did have years of experience fighting Huascar's men, and they would not be so easily scared as Atahualpa's guards once were. So, when Quisquis's soldiers and Pizarro's conquistadors met in a skirmish outside Cuzco, the strengths and weaknesses of their militaries were on full display. Upon seeing Quisquis's men, De Soto and Juan Pizarro charged almost immediately. The Incas massed groups of infantry to face them. While they were greatly outnumbered, and many of their men and horses took severe blows from Inca slings and maces, the plate armor and the speed of their mounts protected the Spanish from losing a single man. Quisquis and his men took potentially hundreds of losses, but the experienced general ensured that his men held their ground. As night fell, both the Spanish and the Incas set up camp within sight of one another. Conquistadors were terrified that Quisquis would attack, and so stayed up the whole night. But when morning came, they found Quisquis's camp empty. He had not only abandoned his camp in the middle of the night, but had even abandoned the entire city of Cuzco. McQuarrie suggests that Quisquis knew his army would stand little chance of defeating a large force of mounted and armored conquistadors on flat and open ground, so it was best to leave. The Pizarros and their new friend Manco marched into the Inca capital unopposed on November 15th. They actually found many friends in the city. The populace of Cuzco had sided with Huascar during the Civil War, and Quisquis's army had kept them under strict martial law ever since his defeat. Pizarro was greeted like a liberator, though not one they were expecting. I think it's important to recognize the significance of what Pizarro has just done by this point, because it is genuinely impressive if you look at it from his point of view. In the space of a few years, and with only a few hundred soldiers, he had kidnapped an emperor, made even the lowliest of his men the equivalent of multimillionaires, and now he held the capital of a hostile force in his grip. He had taken huge gambles at every step of the way, but it had paid off in spades. But his entire enterprise had been just that, a gamble, and any gamble is based on luck. He had been lucky that the Incas were decimated by disease and civil war before he'd even arrived, lucky that Atahualpa was so receptive to his demands for gold and silver, and now lucky that Quisquis had allowed him to just occupy Cuzco. How much longer would that luck last? Pizarro was determined to not find out. Under Manco's leadership and Spanish support, Thousands of men were conscripted to march out and beat back the army that still lurked in the countryside. In the battle that ensued, Kiskis suffered a minor defeat, but it was enough to convince him and his men to abandon the unfriendly Cuzco entirely and head back to Quito, far to the north, where Atahualpa's old power base, their old power base, still was in Ecuador. The Spanish made themselves at home. Manco Capac was crowned Sapa Inca with all the traditions and vestments of his predecessors, but his capital was hardly an Inca one now. The leaders of the expedition took up residences in the palaces of his ancestors. The temples of his gods became convents and churches of the Dominican order. The Spanish took whatever they wanted from the city, not just whatever gold and silver they hadn't had brought to Cajamarca, but also fancy textiles, weapons, and clothing. Pizarro even felt comfortable enough to begin issuing encomiendas to his men, meaning that the uneducated Castilians of peasant blood were now as noble as the lords they had once lived so far beneath in Extremadura. All of this quickly made the opinions of Incan nobility in Cuzco turn. Perhaps the Spanish weren't liberators after all. Perhaps they were only another group of conquerors, and Manco Capac was their puppet. Perhaps Manco himself even began to believe these rumors. In addition to growing Inca opposition, Pizarro faced a threat from his own fellow Christians. Pedro de Alvarado, a familiar face to this podcast, who was last seen ruling Guatemala, heard all about the success in Peru and decided that he wanted a piece of this golden pie. He landed in Ecuador with over 500 men, a force equal to, if not stronger than, Pizarro's own. The governor, as Pizarro was now known, decided to prioritize this threat. He sent his friend, Diego de Almagro, flying up to Ecuador. Almagro was actually fairly lucky. The path he took northward avoided and overtook the army of Quisquis that was still slowly heading home. Almagro made it to Ecuador, met with Alvarado, and struck up a deal favorable to both parties. In return for a healthy sum of 100,000 pesos, Alvarado agreed to hand over control of his army to Pizarro. It turned out that this happened just in time, for no sooner than had the newly arrived conquistadors turned south than Quisquis and his men arrived on the scene. Quisquis was by all accounts quite surprised to find the Spanish so far to the north, but that didn't stop him from putting up a fight. By utilizing the mountainous terrain, he was able to neutralize the advantage of horses by launching several ambushes that captured and killed conquistadors in the dozens. However, Almagro's new force was a most unwelcome surprise to the Incas. They had been together, far away from their families, for many years at this point, fighting Huascar's forces and now the Spanish. They were all eager to go home, but Quisquis was adamant that they carry on the fight. He called them cowards and traitors. In response, his own officers killed him. Nearby, General Rumanavi, that's the one who was rumored to be coming to save Atahualpa, was defeated and executed by a joint Spaniard-Peruvian force in the city of Quito. With these two victories in early 1535, it seemed to Pizarro like things might be finally calming down. Atahualpa's old armies were defeated or disbanded, and Cuzco was in Spanish hands, and a separate Spanish capital was being built on the coast, a city they named La Ciudad de los Reyes, though it would later be named Lima. Conquistadors hung up their armor and walked down the streets of Cuzco in the finest clothes money could buy. More conquistadors arrived all the time, bringing African slaves with them. Pizarro felt comfortable enough that he allowed those Spaniards who didn't receive encomiendas to leave. Thomas says that even the poorest conquistador left with over 20,000 pesos, equivalent to 200 pounds of gold today. The governor focused on constructing Lima, managing his new encomiendas, and attending to his mistress, the half-sister of Atahualpa. For all intents and purposes, Peru appeared to be just like Mexico in 1521. A land subjugated by force of arms and open for Spanish colonization. But just as New Spain had issues sorting out its new Spanish government, so too did Peru. When Hernando Pizarro reached Spain, The Council of Indies made the decision that Peru was too big and too rich for one man to manage. Hernando returned to his brother Francisco with the news that the conquered Inca Empire was to be split in two. The northern half, Peru, was to be ruled by Francisco as normal, but the southern half, Chile, was to be taken over by his lieutenant, Almagro, the one who now effectively controlled the army of Alvarado. Where exactly their dominions began and ended, though, was anybody's guess, since the exact dimensions of Tahuantinsuyu and the right of conquest had to be considered. If Pizarro conquered Cuzco, did that not mean he was entitled to it, even if it lay within the bounds of Almagro's territory? The situation became so tense that the younger Pizarro brothers, Juan and Gonzalo, barricaded a square in Cuzco with cannons, and Juan nearly killed Hernando de Soto, now the city governor, as Pizarro had promised him, when he tried to stop them. Things only calmed down when Francisco arrived and offered to finance Almagro's trip to explore and conquer Chile, which they hoped was just as wealthy as Peru had been. Despite de Soto's loyalty, Almagro picked a different man to lead this expedition as his second in command. In frustration, de Soto packed his things and returned to Spain. And let us not forget the man who was really supposed to have been in charge of it all, Manco Capoc, the 20-year-old Sapa Inca. The Spanish may have been having problems, but he was experiencing conflicts in his own court. Members of the royal family, his family, were forming a faction to replace Manco with his half-brother, a man named Atok Sopa. Manco turned to Almagro for help, who in turn sent his conquistadors to stab Atok Sopa to death in his sleep. But the rival faction continued to organize, and they exploited the divisions between the Spanish to do this. Since Manco was so friendly with Almagro, they allied themselves with the younger Pizarro brothers, Juan and Gonzalo. One night, Manco apparently became so terrified that he might share Atok Sopa's fate that he ran to Almagro's house and hid under his bed. When conquistadors loyal to the Pizarro brothers learned that Manco was no longer at home, they raided his house and carried out whatever loot they found. For a man who was supposedly a god, this was a bit of a personal low point. But when the Spaniards' divisions ended, so too did the opposition to Manco. July 1535 saw Almagro depart Cuzco for Chile. It also saw Francisco Pizarro leave for the coast to oversee Lima's construction. That meant that Manco was left in Cuzco with Pizarro's younger brothers, Juan and Gonzalo, who were far from the kind and lenient friends that Francisco and Almagro had been. Juan and Gonzalo were only 24 and 23 years old, respectively. Not only did they constantly demand that Manco deliver them more gold and more silver, even though he'd nearly looted the entire country, Gonzalo even took an interest in having Manco's wife as his mistress, something that Manco and the rest of the Inca nobility took serious offense with. Macquarie recounts an incident where an Inca general chastised Gonzalo for coveting the Sapa Inca's wife. Gonzalo turned to him and responded by saying this: "Who gave you the authority to talk to the king's magistrate like that? Don't you know what kind of men we Spaniards are? By the king's life, if you don't shut up, I'll seize you and play a game with you and your friends that you'll remember for the rest of your lives. I swear, if you don't keep quiet, I'll slit you open alive and will cut you into little pieces." When Manco offered to pay Gonzalo more silver and gold instead, Gonzalo responded by saying, "Come on, Mr. Manco Inca, let's have the lady. All this silver is good, but she's what we really want." Manco went so far as to dress up his own sister, who looked similar enough, and offered her to Gonzalo by pretending that she was the real queen. But Gonzalo saw through the deception and just kidnapped Manco's wife. It wasn't just the nobility in Cuzco that were suffering at the hands of Spanish greed. Macquarie also talks about Almagro's expedition down into what is now Bolivia and Chile. The men not only robbed and enslaved many of the Incas they encountered on their way south, but they also treated the servants Manco provided horrifically. Villac Umu, the Inca high priest Manco had sent with Almagro, abandoned the expedition along with all the rest of the servants to head back to Cusco, and they reported this. They worked all day long without rest and without eating, except for a little roasted corn and water, and were barbarously imprisoned at night. There was one Spaniard on this expedition who locked 12 Indians in a chain and boasted that all 12 died in it, and that when one Indian died, they cut off his head in order to terrify the others so that they didn't have to undo the padlock on the chain. If some poor Indian got sick or tired, then they routinely beat him until he died from it, because they said that if they were lenient with one, then the rest would become sick or tired. It wasn't until late 1535 that Manco seems to have realized what Atahualpa did 2 years earlier. The Spaniards were not, in fact, going away, nor was their incredible avarice going to subside. Any promises of friendship and equal rule that Pizarro might have promised him were obvious lies. He wasn't much of a Sapa Inca, like Pachacuti had once been. Now he was nothing but a man in fancy clothes, ruling for the Spanish until they had enough conquistadors in Peru that they wouldn't need him anymore and would cast him aside. In November, he secretly met with nobles from across Tehuantinsuyu. He talked about how the Spanish were abusive and greedy, how even if all the snow on the Andes were turned into gold, they would never be satisfied. He talked about how they carelessly took Inca royal women for their mistresses, and how no temple in the entire empire was unlooted. He finished by saying this. Where did we meet them? What is it that we owe them, or which one of them did we injure, with these horses and weapons of iron, they have made such cruel war on us? They killed Atahualpa without cause. They did the same with his captain general, Chalcuchima. They also killed Rumanavi and the Zope Zopahua by burning them to death in Quito so that their souls would not burn with their bodies and couldn't go to enjoy our heaven. It seems to me that it would be neither just nor honest that we put up with this. Rather, we should strive with the utmost determination to either die to the last man or to kill our cruel enemies. That night, Juan and Gonzalo Pizarro also heard of the meeting through spies and stormed into Manco's palace to arrest him, but the Sapa Inca had already slipped out into the mountains. It wasn't until they found one of the nobles heading home and tortured him that he revealed where Manco was heading. Despite Manco's best efforts to escape, the Pizarros caught up with him and imprisoned him, hurling abuse and threats at the man who was now most definitely their prisoner. Though the emperor had been captured, his subjects carried out his orders. All across the land of four parts, militias were organized. Spanish lords were murdered on their own encomiendas. An army tens of thousands strong began to form, but it needed Manco to lead it properly. Manco languished in prison, plotting his escape, but his salvation came from a most unexpected source, the Emperor Charles. Hernando Pizarro, if you'll remember, made a trip back to Spain to show off the loot that he and his brothers had seized for themselves and their emperor. Charles himself met with Hernando and lectured him on the treatment of the Sapa Incas. They may have been foreign and pagan, but they were still royalty and deserved to be given the respect afforded to any European monarch. You'll remember that he was quite saddened to hear of Atahualpa's death back in 1533. So when Hernando returned to Peru and found the new Sapa Inca, Manco, imprisoned, he freed him almost immediately. Gonzalo and Juan protested, of course, citing the insurrections going on across the country, but Hernando assured them that Manco was trustworthy, and with the emperor's authority invested in him, there was nothing they could do. Manco was not trustworthy. On April 18th, 1536, he convinced Hernando to let him and Viac Umu, the high priest, leave Cusco for a secluded spot in the mountains. It was for a religious ceremony honoring his father, Huayna Capac, and they could bring back a solid gold statue of the former Sapa Inca if they went. So Manco and Viac Umu departed, and coming to the town of Lares, found, as was predetermined, more nobles and generals waiting for them from across the Inca Empire. Manco stood from his royal litter and began to speak. I can't help but remind you of how many times you have asked me to do that which I am now intending to do, saying that I should rise up against them, and asking me why I had allowed them in my hand. I didn't think that what is happening now would ever have occurred. Yet that's what happened, and because all they want is to persist in angering and tormenting me, I will be forced to do the same with them. Since you have always shown me so much love and have endeavored to make me happy, let's all join together and unite as one, and send our messengers throughout the land so that in 20 days' time, everyone will arrive in this town, without the bearded ones knowing anything about it. I will send my captain, Kizoyu Panqui, to attack Lima, so that the day we attack the Spaniards here, he and his men will attack those who are there. And together, with him there and ourselves here, we will finish them off to the last man, and thus we will end this nightmare that has been hanging over us. I'm determined to leave no Christian alive in this land. Next time, we will see what comes out of Manco's great rebellion against the Spanish. Will the Sapa Inca reclaim the glory of his ancestors and drive Pizarro and his men out into the Pacific once more? Or will Tawantinsuyu be stuck under a Spanish boot once and for all?